If you read any account of why the Roman Empire fell, you're likely to come across stories of barbarian invasions, political intrigue, even economic collapse. But add one more to the mix: climate change. That's what a new study published in the journal Science suggests. It was written by a team from the Swiss Federal Institute for Forest, Snow, and Landscape Research. They analyzed tree rings on pieces of ancient wood and scoured peat bogs in old Roman ruins. Michael Mann is a professor of meteorology at Penn State University, and he joins me now to explain this new research. Welcome.
Great to be here.
We are talking about the period from 250 to about 550 AD. These are the final centuries of Roman imperial dominance. Describe what was happening with respect to the climate.
Well, at the end of the period, it appears that the climate began to become more variable. Rainfall patterns and temperature patterns fluctuated more from year to year and from decade to decade. And the authors argue that that presented some real challenges for civilization and may have had a substantial role in the downfall of the Roman Empire.
This study went back 2,500 years. One of the ways they did this was to look at tree rings, right? I mean, they had about 9,000 samples. They looked at peat bogs and ruins. And I guess in years where the weather is good, the tree rings are bigger. And when the weather is bad, the rings are smaller. Is that about right?
Exactly. And so they were able to tease out two different pieces of information from these trees. They can get some idea of how warm the summers were and how wet the sort of late spring, early summer was.
So, for example, would it be cold and wet and rainy one year and then really hot the next year? Was it that dramatic?
I think that's basically the conclusion that they're drawing.
You're a meteorologist, and the scientists who worked on this are also not historians, but you have a basic understanding of what was happening on the ground at the time. I mean, what are some of the theories for how the fluctuations in the climate could have contributed to the collapse of the Roman Empire?
Well, the Roman Empire was a large empire, and like any large civilization, including the civilization we have today, it was highly dependent on predictability of natural resources, the predictability of water supply, the predictability of food resources. It was very heavily adapted to the climate conditions that had persisted for centuries. So whenever you have unpredictable and dramatic changes in climate, you're likely to see challenges such as those that led presumably to the fall of the Roman Empire.
Michael Mann, do we know why this was happening? I mean, this is long before industrialization. So presumably, can we rule out human interference?
Well, there are a number of factors that we know are responsible for natural variability of the climate. The amount of energy put out by the sun varies from decade to decade and century to century enough to cause some degree of climate variability. We also know a volcanic eruption can cool the global climate for several years. And so presumably it was some combination of these external natural factors like solar variability and volcanic eruptions and just the pure sort of chaotic internal variability of the climate system like we see today. Right now we are experiencing a very substantial La Niña event in the tropical Pacific, and that's influencing weather patterns around the globe. That's a natural phenomenon. El Niño and La Niña come and go naturally. So these are the sorts of concerns that would have played out in the past and are playing out today as we proceed with this uncontrolled experiment of changing our climate.
That's Michael Mann. He's a professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the author of the book Dire Predictions: Understanding Global Warming. Michael Mann, thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
We're going to talk about a book for children right now, not with our old friend Daniel Pinkwater. We need a little mathematical expertise for this one. The book is called You Can Count on Monsters. It's about prime numbers and prime factorizations. Thankfully, we have a math whiz, our old friend Keith Devlin, on the line. He joins us from Stanford. Welcome back, Keith.
Thanks, Scott. It's good to be talking about a math book I can actually enjoy.
The book, You Can Count on Monsters, is written by Richard Evan Schwartz, and he's a math professor at Brown University. I'm assuming you guys go to conventions together or something, right?
I actually haven't met the author, but I was at a convention a couple of weeks ago. I was browsing the book display. Mm-hmm. There was this one book in the corner, just jumped out. I grabbed over, I talked to the publisher, and I said, I've got to talk to Scott about this on NPR. This is one of the most amazing math books for kids I have ever seen.
Well, help us understand it. Firstly, the illustrations are extraordinary.
Oh, yeah, they just jump out. It's beautiful. I mean, the author, who's a professor of mathematics at Brown, has this incredible ability to do really good artwork, the kind of artwork that appeals to anyone from the ages of sort of 2 or 3 years old all the way to being elderly like myself. It's great colours, it's wonderful, and yet because he knows the mathematics, he very skillfully and subtly embeds mathematical ideas into the drawings. You can tell it's sort of mathematical because his monsters in the book, it's all about monsters.
Every number gets a monster.
That's right, and they look vaguely geometrical, and the prime monsters are monsters that can't be broken up into simpler monsters, like the prime numbers, and the composite monsters are made up of simpler monsters. In fact, if you look at each composite monster, part of the fun is figuring out how the artist has embedded all of the prime monsters in it, so the monsters follow the structure of the numbers. It's beautifully done.
And what's the best working definition of a prime number?
A prime number is a number that's only divisible by itself and 1. 1 itself is excluded, so the examples are 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19. Composite numbers, the non-primes, are the ones which can be broken up into a product of smaller numbers, like 4, which is 2 times 2, 6, which is 2 times 3, or 15, which is 3 times 5.
Take a look, Keith. You have the book in front of you?
I have the book in front of me.
Take a look at 31.
The number 31. Okay, let's have a look at this one. Flick, 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 flick.
It's just beautifully serpentine.
Oh, the serpentine, the snake, and you have to find out where there's a 31. And my guess is there's probably 31 corners in there, but I might be wrong. I might not have to sit down and count, and kids would love to do the counting. Kids love to recognise patterns. They love to count. And in each of these, you have to find out where's the 31 in there. And it's gorgeous. I mean, the other nice thing is the diagrams are clearly geometrical because they have corners and edges, but they have personalities.
Yeah.
I mean, these monsters are fun creatures that you would like to have as pets. Well, and, I would.
Yeah, no, I would too, particularly 31. Youngsters can start thumbing through this book at any age. And really,
I would think at any age, yeah.
Begin to understand at the age of, let's say, 5 or 6, I should think.
Yeah, and the parents, I mean, parents, even the non-mathematical parents, don't really need to be afraid of this one because the parent can learn as he or she is going along because there's a little guide at the front and a little bit of information at the back to help you understand what's going on. And it's only counting and multiplication.
The illustrations in this book help make a visual association for youngsters so that it's characterized in their heads. It's not just, forgive me saying this to you, Keith, it's not just a bunch of numbers. They become kind of real properties of the way they see the world.
Oh, indeed, and that's the point. The thing that distinguishes mathematicians is that we, at some stage in our development, we develop this understanding that numbers do have personalities, they have structures, they have relationships. We form that, but most people don't manage to get it. What Schwarz has managed to do is use his own skill as an artist to bring out some of the personalities. And the point is that what he brings out through his art is actually the structure and the personality that those of us in the business have always seen. We just haven't had the tools and the ability to make it accessible the way Schwarz has managed. It's the skill he has as an artist that makes it work.
Keith, thanks so much for bringing this to our attention.
My pleasure. I'm just delighted to get the word about this wonderful book out there.
Our math guy, Keith Devlin, speaking from Stanford. Thanks so much, Keith.
Okay, great. That was fun.
And you can see a slideshow of the illustrations in You Can Count on Monsters on our website, NPR.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Time for sports.
Standing tall as Zeus upon the fields of Thessaly, the monsters of the Midway Sunday gird for battle upon the frozen Midwest tundra, dreaming of Packers vanquished like Typhon beneath Mount Etna.
Yeah, and the Jets are playing the Steelers. Joined now by NPR's Tom Goldman. Morning, Tom.
You're nutty.
big revelation to people listening especially. Listen, I guarantee you we're mostly going to talk about football, but I want to begin with a story this week. You've reported the latest Lance Armstrong controversy, new charges of persistent blood doping. If a CC of this is true, is there a consequence or end to all this?
Possible indictments, possible trials, more muck certainly for the sport of elite cycling. You know, Scott, an interesting small print story amidst these headlines about Armstrong. You remember Floyd Landis, the cyclist mm-hmm. whose doping admission last year and doping allegations against Armstrong prompted the current criminal investigation. Landis announced he's retiring from the sport, and he had this parting shot. He said, "The fight versus doping can't be won. You have to legalize it, medically monitor it, and make sure people don't hurt themselves." Is that crazy, or maybe worth it to make it part of the discussion?
Okay, the main event. New York Jets play the Steelers in Pittsburgh for the AFC Championship. Yeah. Jets beat the Steelers last month, the regular season. But would any sane man, or for that matter, you or me, bet against Ben Roethlisberger in the playoffs?
You know, the Jets have been wonderful on the road, beating Peyton Manning and the Colts, of course, and Tom Brady and the Patriots, the Porsche and Cadillacs of quarterbacks and teams. But, you know, with Big Ben and the Steelers, they're playing a big four-wheel drive rig that loves going off-road. You know, if the Jets bring the rush on Ben Roethlisberger, it's hard to bring him down. He's as big as many of the defenders. He loves going off script when the game breaks down into a schoolyard game, as they like to say. Roethlisberger shines. So combine that with super safety Troy Polamalu, the best run defense in the NFL. Big game experience, Scott. This is the fourth AFC championship for all these guys since 2005. No, in answer to your question, I wouldn't bet against Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I'm going to say Steelers 28, Jets 17.
Now, I think that's good.
Okay, and you? Huh?
I don't know about the score, but I think the Steelers, yeah.
All right. Now, I don't have to tell anybody about how I feel about this game, but devoted a Bear fan as I am, nobody has a hotter hand now than Aaron Rodgers and the Packers. And the three-point advantage the odds makers have given them seems even a little small to me.
Well, you know, I think the odds makers are very cognizant of a very good Chicago defense. You know, a classic Chicago defense, great pass rush, linebackers. They've got good defensive backs, too. Aaron Rodgers is as good as his offensive line is, and certainly the Bears are going to be bringing it.
Yeah, I want to know how he throws the ball sitting on his keister with Julius Peppers all over him.
He's good enough to maybe do that. Yeah.
You know, he is. Now, could the great Devin Hester make the difference?
He could, you know, in a tight game. Certainly field position is a big issue here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially if it's cold,
it'll be cold, Tom.
It'll be cold. Yeah. But, with his great punt returning, yes, putting the Bears in good position, he could, as he often does, make the difference.
Okay. Predictions. All right. I'll go first. President Obama, I'm going to go with his prediction. He said Bears 20. The Pac 17, Bears 20 on a Matt Fort touchdown run, a Cutler to Hester pass, and two Robbie Gould field goals.
I like it. I'm not going to go against the president or you. I like the ring of that Pittsburgh-Chicago Super Bowl. You got to use the John Facenda voice with that.
Oh, my gosh. Two great Midwestern teams joined in battle upon the frozen tundra that stretches between the Alleghenies and Lake Michigan.
Oh, my God.
Matt Forte. How could I mispronounce his name? NPR's Tom Goldman. Thanks.
It's always a pleasure.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Viewers of MSNBC's Countdown with Keith Olbermann heard a surprise announcement last night.
I think the same fantasy has popped into the head of everybody in my business who has ever been told what I've been told, that this is going to be the last edition of your show.
With those words, Keith Olbermann, MSNBC's highest-rated host, announced he's leaving the network. MSNBC issued a three-sentence statement saying it had ended its contract with Mr. Olbermann, thanked him for what it called his integral role in MSNBC's success, and said we wish him well in his future endeavors. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is following the story. David, thanks for joining us.
You bet.
Did Keith Olbermann jump or was he pushed?
Well, you know, specifically, we don't know. What we do know is that Mr. Olbermann had an extremely contentious relationship with the executives who run MSNBC, as he has at other places, including ESPN, where he really made his national name in the past. What he said last night in his show was simply he told viewers that, you know, quote, all that surrounded the show was too much for me. Behind the scenes, really, there had been a lot of tension, and it had been accelerated by instances in which, in the past, the head of General Electric, the owner of NBC, had to intervene to kind of quell this ongoing on-air feud between him and Bill O'Reilly of the Fox News Channel. And also the question last fall when Olbermann had to be punished by MSNBC President Phil Griffin for giving political contributions to several Democratic candidates for Congress. Olbermann was essentially unrepentant after his two-day suspension and returned to air, making the case that opinion journalists aren't surprising anyone by having party affinities. You know, there's one other question that's being raised by a lot of Olbermann's fans and supporters in the blogosphere, and it's the question of whether the cable giant Comcast, which has just gotten regulatory approval to take over NBC and its sister networks, including MSNBC, whether Comcast had something to do with that, whether there was some political payoff. About the only thing that Comcast and NBC officials would comment on the record last night was to say that Comcast has not taken operational control of MSNBC yet and had nothing to do with the decision, that it was informed of the decision by MSNBC and NBC News officials after the fact.
And what did Keith Olbermann and his show do for MSNBC?
Mr. Olbermann and his show Countdown defined MSNBC and made it into a ratings and a profitable success. MSNBC had really lurched about for a defining approach since its inception in 1996. What Olbermann did, he defined it as a voice of opposition during the Bush years. He defined it as a place, much like Fox News is clearly on the right in its prime time, a place where liberals could find their concerns and voices heard in a way that hadn't been the case on cable networks. So he took it to the left and built a cadre of fairly like-minded primetime opinion hosts, and suddenly MSNBC shot above CNN to be the second highest rated cable news show in the country.
And what does MSNBC do to fill the hour now?
Well, they've built the bench a lot in the last couple of years. They take Lawrence O'Donnell, whose show The Last Word appeared later in the evening, and they're going to plug it in at 8 p.m., which is when Olbermann's show on the East Coast time aired. And at 10 o'clock, they're taking Ed Schultz, who'd been a longtime radio show host, who they've been grooming and having as a host of late, and they're putting him from 6 o'clock up there till 10 o'clock at night. They feel they've got a deeper bench. They're clearly building around Rachel Maddow, something of a protege of Mr. Olbermann's, a former Air America host on radio, who really has groomed over the years into quite a strong presence on her own right. The real question is, can she continue to get such strong ratings in the absence of the lead-in of Mr. Olbermann?
And with a contract reportedly worth $30 million, presumably he doesn't have to do anything else immediately, but any indication?
Well, not only does he not have to do anything else immediately, but under the terms of the buyout, MSNBC made it quite clear last night that he doesn't get to work for any of their television competitors. You know, he is a strong presence. He's built up quite a following on Twitter. He could well do something in radio. He could do it on the web, or he could count his money and figure out what he wants to do next. There have been a lot of chapters in this bumpy but illustrious career.
NPR's David Folkenflik, thanks so much.
You bet.